I can tell it's a humid morning. My pages are sticking together. So at this latitude right now, we stand between the first harvest and the second. The grain that gives us beer and bread has already arrived. The corn and tomatoes and peaches and berries are showing up everywhere, and soon they'll be even more plentiful. In another few weeks, it will be time for pumpkins, the third harvest, but that's not yet. Growing a crop requires paying a lot of attention to weather, to condition, to the chemistry of the soil, to pests, to planning ahead for various problems and issues that might arise or might not. Growing a crop requires doing things at the time that they're needed. You can't do them early, and you better not do them late. That's a kind of effort I personally find difficult. I'm more likely to sit back and enjoy the first 6 weeks of a 10-week class and then cram frantically for the exam. I won't ask if anybody here does the same. But those two processes are often framed as either or. Either you pay attention in every moment, taking care of everything when it's needed, or you coast until it's time for one last big push. Well, you may get away with cramming for an exam, but you can't do a season's watering after a month of drought and expect that to work. I think in most of our real lives, though, we're somewhere in between. Sometimes we take time off. Sometimes we engage in necessary self-care, which can look like pleasure, by the way. Other times we do the work that's most important, whatever that work looks like, and I don't just mean employment. And still other times we're working with total focus and accomplishing much, sometimes in an amazingly short time. For a lot of us, certainly for me, our ability to focus depends on our attitudes, big and small, what we think about what we're doing, and also how we understand our lives, how we see our place in the world, what we think about how the universe works. When I'm in fear, it looks like I don't have enough of anything. Time, money, food, energy, brain power, whatever. I feel like I have to pedal as fast as I can and I'm still not getting anywhere. When I'm able to trust, it looks like I've got plenty of everything. Breath, memory, focus, coherence, friends, everything. I can feel like everything is easy. But most of the time, the accurate picture is somewhere in between. And a lot of the time, my attitudes are somewhere in between, too. I want to hold the attitude that is the most satisfying or the most productive, the most useful for whatever it is I'm trying to do. But I notice my attitudes and emotions aren't the same from day to day. Maybe you have that experience, too. Everything in our lives is cyclical, even the things we think of as linear or directional. We've heard that it's better or more blessed to give than to receive, but it actually works better if we all do both. True story. A few years ago, a friend of mine was injured and needed significant help for several weeks for everything from rides and cooking to help getting dressed. My friend had a hard time asking for help, even with the assistance of the Caring and Sharing Committee in that congregation. Until one day, somebody thanked them while giving them a ride. "Because," said the driver, "the fact that you have asked for help and let me help you is making it easier for me to feel okay about asking for help after my surgery next week." When we focused on only giving, are we assuming that the other person is only allowed to receive? How would that feel to them? How would that feel to us? What would the harvest of such a thing be? Time is a cycle, too. The seasons come around in a year-long repeating cycle, summer, fall, winter, spring. Our lives take a longer cycle. We begin as helpless infants, dependent on our parents for sustenance and shelter. We grow to maturity with ever-expanding capabilities and interests. Most of us reach the peak of our physical powers in our 20s and 30s. The peak of our mental powers in our 40s and 50s, and the peak of our wisdom in our 70s or later. I'm still hoping. Inevitably, at some point, our physical ability declines, which is why I gave up my ice skates a couple of decades ago. Our mental abilities decline more slowly, but I think each of us knows someone or is someone who no longer remembers names well, who has forgotten whether they read the book or saw the movie or only heard about it from friends. Those jokes about senior moments didn't come from nothing. Until eventually, if we live so long, somewhere after 60 for most of us, and sometime before we reach 100 for nearly all of us, eventually we become dependent on others for sustenance, shelter, safety, a cycle. And one in which sometimes we receive, sometimes we give, sometimes we feel powerful, and sometimes we feel weak. Occasionally, all of those at the same time. In the farm life of so many of our ancestors, and some of us now, we observe plenty of cycles: plowing, planting, cultivating, weeding, watering, harvesting. What about celebrating? Do we always remember to celebrate? I don't know about you, but my grandmother used to talk about the harvest parties that her grandmother would host. But nowadays, well, in my family of origin, in my nuclear family of origin, celebration was often left out. We celebrated calendar events, but it was considered egotistical to celebrate achievement or to congratulate ourselves on a job well done. The right reply to any praise was, "Aw, shucks," or "It was nothing." And yet, celebration is a natural part of the achievement cycle, and one we would do well to honor and, well, celebrate. We need to receive our joy, not just step quickly past it to the next chore. What can we celebrate just now in the harvest of our lives at just this moment? As members of USG, we can celebrate the arrival of a new director of spiritual development. We can celebrate the recent ordinations of two ministers who served our congregation during their training years. We can celebrate the start of our elevator project at long last. As members of the broader UUA, we can celebrate the participation of UUs from around the country in the efforts to help the families lately separated at our southern border, as Sarah was telling us before. We can celebrate the renewed work on anti-racism at the continental UUA level. But notice what happens when we talk about those things. If my examples become larger and larger, they also become farther and farther away. They become a little more ambiguous, each celebration colored by all the messiness that is still with us. Now, some of us want to apologize for the crimes committed by our ancestors while ignoring the aggressions and microaggressions we commit day to day in our own lives. And yet, the work of giving and receiving, of apology and forgiveness, of expressing gratitude and meeting challenge is best done in person, a lesson I have had to keep learning. So let me bring my question back to here and now and make it personal. What have you personally accomplished in the very recent past, this month, say, that you can celebrate as a successful harvest? Maybe something small, maybe something huge. It's not a competition, and I won't ask you to say it out loud. But I just want to invite you to actually notice moments when it felt like you were successful. I want us all to notice moments when we feel like what we did was good. My recent ones, for example, include getting 3 writing projects to completion right at deadline. Now, none of them were more than 10 pages, so it's not like I'm celebrating huge stuff. And I'm certainly not celebrating that they were perfect, but no writing project is ever perfect. I'm celebrating that I was able to declare them done and send them out in the world before they were late. Sometimes that's a big accomplishment. Some days I can celebrate that I made all the phone calls that were on that day's list, though some days I can't. Just last week, I finally made the call about getting my car inspected before the end of the month. Phew. It's good to celebrate those things, and when we give ourselves adequate acknowledgement for our successes, even the little ones, that gives us more ability to have more successes. How do you think I made it through grad school at 64? Had to celebrate every little thing as a successful harvest in order to get the energy for the next piece. So I don't want to glide past celebration too fast. It's good to take more than a moment to honor the work that went into what we've accomplished and to give thanks for whatever help we've had in getting to this harvest. And of course, eventually it'll be time to look to the next harvest. Now, I used to think that planting was the first step toward a harvest, but it actually begins even earlier. Before we can begin to plan the next crop, we need to evaluate the last one. What did we plant last time and how well did we do? So the first step is reviewing the harvest just completed. What did you receive after all your work? What flourished in the garden of your life this season and what languished? What weeds had to be pulled up repeatedly? Some of my weeds are named Spider Solitaire. Others are named Facebook. And don't forget overcommitment and staying up too late. But I bet some of you have weeds too. What came up that you didn't expect or hadn't even realized you planted? And then, of course, what crops got stunted because of your inattention? What wonderful crops just seem to have shown up without much effort on your part, like tomato volunteers from a long-ago garden? And when you've looked at all that, then it's time to look at what would you like to plant again in a future season? What crops would you just as soon prevent? What adjustments do you want to make next time so your next harvest is better? If I want, for example, a more friendly apartment community, I can start planting that by saying warm hellos to people and looking them in the eye, even on the elevator. If I want a more inclusive community, I can start by shopping in stores where people of several visible styles congregate. I can notice the things about a stranger that are matters of taste or action rather than permanent differences between us. And my favorite example of that one is when I was an engineer in the 70s and I was the only woman in the department, and guys would compliment each other on a machinery installation or a design or a timetable. And they would compliment me on my eyes or my butt, the differences between us. You can tell a lot about the farmer by the quality of the harvest, and our lives are like that too. If in some future season I manage to harvest a book, it'll be because I planted the seeds, wrote the drafts, continued to cultivate it, encouraged it to grow all the way to completion. If, on the other hand, all I have left is a file drawer full of false starts and rough draft ideas, well, that will tell you something about me as a writer, won't it? I've been studying consent culture lately, anti-racism, gender equality, patient autonomy. Some of you will recognize all of those. Some of you recognize only one or two. One thing they all have in common is that we notice that whatever culture is dominant in the room tends to center itself and mark out some participants as other. But othering people is always damaging. I want to be able to talk about and write about sex and love, race, gender, age, ability, and religion from a place of true neutrality, allowing for everyone's experience to be equally seen, noted, appreciated, and valued. But instead, everywhere I turn, I find that we each speak from a viewpoint. Recently, I've participated in structured group conversations on several challenging topics, one topic at a time, some of them here and some of them elsewhere, in groups where a host of different opinions were represented. As you would expect, each time I found some opinions easier to listen to than others. As you would also expect, I found it easier to listen to people who agreed with me. No surprise, right? But later I realized there was another layer of difference in that group besides which side are you on. Some of the people in each room were speaking abstractly, thoughtfully, philosophically, their opinions informed by reading and thinking, their sources, the scientific findings, humanist ideals, religious teachings, ethical standards, opinions of people they respect. Other people were speaking concretely out of their lived experience, a lifetime of moments of feeling their bodies were on the line in one way or another, their livelihoods, their families, their jobs or homes under threat. Everyone in those conversations seemed well-intentioned about the discussions, and each time it seemed that everyone was participating fully. And yet, it was clearly a different conversation for people who felt themselves at risk than for people who felt safe. Perhaps that's inevitable, but the moment that I realized it, it rather took me up short. It seems to me that this is a divide that is at the root of all our most divisive challenges, and it's another fabulous argument in favor of diversity in all things. As long as the people with lived experience are kept off the decision-making panels, maybe those decisions really can't be appropriately fair, just, equitable, and all the other things we'd like them to be. And that's equally true if they're represented, if they're unrepresented because of accident or convenience, as it is if they're unrepresented because some group calling itself we has kept some group calling them off. Looking at that harvest, what can we know about what we have planted? What can we change for the next harvest? Now, I'm not addressing that to us as a body, though of course thinking as a body is useful too, but I'm really addressing that to each of us. What can I know about what I have planted, given that that's the harvest and it's in my world? What can I change? What am I willing to give? What am I willing to give up? And what am I willing to receive? Begin with the end in mind. Our policy governance takes us there. And so I want to look ahead to the end that I would seek, which would be fair, just, equitable for everybody. There's a move in the UUA to broaden that from humans to everybody. I'll go with that. And I think each of us has to start with where we are, wherever that is. I never know how to end a sermon, so today I'll take the advice I've recently heard about what to say when you don't know what to say. I'm sorry the sermon hasn't been perfect. I forgive you for whatever thoughts you have that were critique. I thank you for listening. I love you. Go in peace. Blessed be.